It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. It will come as no surprise that Doug Smock is a retired newspaper reporter and magazine editor, because you would have to have that kind of background to do the kind of research required to write Forgotten Battles and American Memory.
I did a lot of it during the pandemic, and I was fortunate to have a great local library and reference department. I also visited the battle sites and did some first-person research also in the Marshall Foundation Library in Lexington, Virginia, where I got a lot of really great documents that had never been reviewed before. They were very useful, particularly in the Battle for Burma chapter. I grew up in the Pittsburgh area next to a place where a British army led by a British general named Braddock was absolutely demolished by a group of Native Americans and a small group of French Marines. And I always wondered why it was never taught in the schools. It was completely ignored. Then when I moved to Weymouth about 10 years ago, I had the exact same feeling, because a block down the street was a site where Miles Standish led a genocide of Massachusetts tribe in 1623. And that was also totally ignored. So I wanted to learn more, Alice. And I started writing stories for local papers and history blogs. And I met leaders of the Massachusetts tribe who told me that they had lost so much that they wanted to make sure that their history was never taken away from them. And as I brought the Miles Standish story up to date in writing for these local papers, I discovered that another tribe, the Wampanoags, were trying to do exactly that in an effort to get a gambling casino sited in Boston. Then later I read of older Chinese people who did not want the memory of their terrible losses in World War II to ever be forgotten. So that led me to start working on the book, expanding my stories, looking for other stories where history really had not been told. And as I got more and more into it, Alice, I felt that I wanted to tell a bigger story than just what happened in a battle. I didn't really want it to be a military history book alone, but I wanted to tell a bigger story about American history, and even in some cases, places where American history intersects with other countries, like particularly in China for my Battle of Burma chapter.
When you say you wanted to get the big picture, what do you mean?
Well, for example, one of the battles I chose to look at was the Fort Pillow Massacre. It was a takeover of fort during the Civil War in 1864 by Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest. And it turned out it was a garrison of newly freed slaves who were black soldiers and newly enlisted in the Union Army, who really had virtually no training, no combat experience. They put up a good fight, but they were overwhelmed by a much larger force. And after they surrendered, Forrest's cavalry slaughtered them. He killed them all after they had surrendered. Southern historians had really sugarcoated the story. They had never told the full truth, because Nathan Bedford Forrest had been a venerated cavalry leader, even by people like Shelby Foote, who's made famous in the Ken Burns Civil War series, and by William Faulkner. They thought he was the greatest gentleman who ever walked through the door, even though he was a slave trader and before the war, and leader of the Ku Klux Klan after the war, and he led this massacre. There was constantly an effort to cover up that story. So I wanted to tell the whole story. I read a ton of first-person accounts. I found even a Confederate account of someone who said that Bedford Forrest was involved in the slaughter of the black troops. And it wasn't even until recently that a Southern historian named Brian Steele Wills was willing to acknowledge that there, in fact, was a massacre, let alone that Bedford Forrest was leading that massacre. And then it got into all of the issues with the Black Lives Matter movement starting to demand removal of the statues. And they had control of some places like the city of Memphis, but still the Tennessee state legislature did everything they could to keep his memory intact, even though he was not someone that, you know, history remembers very kindly. And that's an example of the bigger story.
I think a lot of our history has been, quote unquote, whitewashed. It's very disturbing on so many levels because you make one example of some, you know, glaring things that were left out and you wonder, gee, I wonder how much else there is, right?
Well, I'll give you one more kind of stunning example. The Massachusetts state flag has Miles Standish's saber hanging over the head of a Native American standing at rest. I mean, we have glorified his genocide of the Native American race in our state flag. One other thing I came across, Alice, that really fascinated me was I referenced the Battle of Burma in World War II. It's extremely forgotten, little known. Everybody focuses on D-Day in Europe and Iwo Jima and Midway, but we had a very significant effort to help the Chinese resist the Japanese after their invasion in the late 1930s. We couldn't commit a lot of troops, but we did send General Joseph Still over there, and we sent an enormous amount of aid. We became very committed to building a new military supply road, and we did send in about 10,000 soldiers, the Merrill's Marauders, and later the Mars Task Force to liberate the Burma Road. What they did is pretty much forgotten in the United States, but I found it extremely fascinating that there's a huge effort underway in China by private citizens to build memorials and monuments to Stillwell and the American soldiers, along with the Chinese national soldiers who fought the Chinese. That seems kind of incredulous, given all the rhetoric between the Chinese government and the American government, particularly highlighted with Nancy Pelosi's visit. But there's a groundswell local movement, not initiated by the government at all, but by private citizens, to build these memorials and monuments to the American soldiers, in addition to the national soldiers who fought the Japanese. And there's an enormous amount of gratitude for what the Americans did in China in the 1940s. But in the United States, there's absolutely no memorials to Stillwell, no museums, no nothing, nor are there soldiers remembered. And it was a lot of these stories are personal to me, Alice, which is another reason I wanted to do it. I learned about the Battle for Burma from my father, who was a soldier there. But I thought maybe hopefully some people will read it and teachers might recommend it to students in addition to our history books, which are so, you know, like you said earlier, just so whitewashed. And it's the least common denominator. It's what the Texas School Board Commission is willing to accept, which is very, very little, you know. So our students get almost no sense of Black history, Native American history, women's history, you know, a lot of things in context that are extremely important to learn about. And I've been giving lectures through the UMass Boston Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, and they many of them are open to the public and well-publicized. And the six stories are, first of all, is Miles Standish and Wessex Gossett, then Braddock's defeat near Pittsburgh in the French and Indian War, then the Battle of Cowpens in the Revolutionary War, then the Battle of Lake Erie in the War of 1812, then the Fort Pillow Massacre in the Civil War, and then it's Joseph Stillwell in the Battle for Burma in World War II. Those are the six stories in my first book.
All right, Doug, looking forward to the next one. Marlita Smith worked with juvenile criminal justice for 24 years, and she continues to influence children's lives through her book, An Awakening of My Kid Human Powers.
As a youngster, you know, my parents, they were divorced, and it was really a kind of a rough time for me. So I did a lot of journaling, a lot of poetry, and I was a Girl Scout. And so I would do a lot of storytelling with my friends and all my Girl Scout, you know, troops. And that was the development of my writing. But how this book came about is I was at my granddaughter's soccer game, and I was just observing, you know, the parents. They were just coaching their kids and, you know, by any means necessary, get this goal. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, like, why in the world are these parents, you know, not teaching these kids values? It just didn't settle right with me. That evening, I went to sleep, and around 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and the book was in my head. From the color to the characters to the book set up everything. I'm saying it was God. That's what I'm saying. It's called An Awakening of My Kid Human Powers, and it's lighthearted, beautifully illustrated, very diverse, inclusive, encouraging, and empowering. And it really focuses on, you know, self-esteem and core character concepts, like character traits. For instance, like compassion, courage, generosity, honesty, love, caring, and sharing. I don't have characters per se. They're just character concepts. So for example, I have kid compassion. And kid compassion, she's compassionate about the environment and how it's being destroyed. And so in the book, she shares a poem that speaks about how she's feeling about what we're doing to the earth. Kid generosity, for an example, it's an illustration of two kids, one an African girl and a little boy that is dressed in a cowboy gear, and he drops his lunch and she offers her lunch to share with him.
So it's not a story per se, it's like little stories within a story.
Exactly, that, you know, parents and children can relate to, because, you know, once you're looking at these kids doing these core concepts and sharing their character traits with other people, you start to look at yourself and say, you know, I have some of those characteristics, and, you know, I haven't really been displaying them like I should. You know, and it makes you think, and that's what this book is. It's very thought-provoking, you know, very transformative, meaning that, you know, it causes a typical reaction in you. Lately, I've been going to my granddaughter's school, and I've been just reading the book to the kids, and they're excited about it. And then in the end of the book, if you don't mind, I'll just read. It asks, these are just a few examples of what defines a kid human power. Now, do you have a story that makes you feel like a hero? I bet mom and dad would love to hear them. And then it asks, you know, those questions of the kids, and they all raise their hand and they're like, I helped my mom feed my brother, or, you know, I did this for my dad. And, you know, they have all these beautiful examples of what makes them a hero. And I just love reading to kids. And, you know, even the teachers, they say, oh, wow, that is so encouraging. You know, my students, I've never seen them react, you know, so positively before. So I feel I have an impact and I feel happy about doing that. I've already donated my book to the local library. I was featured in a kids magazine and also our local magazine here where I reside. And, also, I've been doing a couple of interviews.
Great, Marlita. That's the way to draw attention to your book. Thanks so much. Stan Corey wrote a book called When Work Becomes Optional, in which he says, retirement is not about age. It's about when the dollar is not the driver and you do things because it's important to you from your heart. So he's following his own advice in publishing Sailing Adventures of Mac Brown.
Part of my own wanting to have leave a little bit about myself for my grandkids to know something more about my childhood. And I started boating when I was about 5 years old and continued to be on around the water most all of my life. Six short stories. The core story is true, and I've embellished it around the edges to make it a little more interesting, a little more fun for a read for children. And grew up on Long Island and sailing Long Island Sound, boating on Long Island Sound, New England, all over. The core story for the first one is about a sailfish, which is a little boat that back in the 50s, so you could buy a kit. I guess my father and a number of other built these sailboats called sailfish. And they were like a surfboard. And when I was about 9 years old, it looked really pretty off the beach, and I could see Connecticut across the Long Island Sound. It was a clear day, and I started sailing towards it, not thinking about anything at 9 years old. No life jacket, no water, no anything. And about 2 hours later, my mother realized I wasn't around. And Coast Guard found me halfway across the Long Island Sound.
Oh.
And I was having a grand old time out there and saw a lot of sea life and other things. And so I made the story more about the sail out there. And then I added some things about the sea life. And then I had some, you know, little thrilling things here and there. So it's kind of fun. One of the other stories is about a dolphin being caught in a creek. I grew up on this creek, and so helping the dolphin find the exit to the creek. So that's another fun story. And then the other ones are just exploring the creek and the marshes and the little canals around in the creek. And with my buddies at that time, and, you know, we would swim, we'd snorkel, take a gig with you, and catch, you know, eels or flounders or whatever. And we'd go fishing at times. And it was just an interesting life. And there was when I was about 10 years old or so, I bought a dinghy. I saved up some money and we would go off into the creek with my friends and fish and so forth. So that was stories about getting the dinghy and time with the dinghy, fishing and stuff. And just more of what boys I read the first story in a little school group that I was using as sort of a test reading, getting their feedback through fourth graders. And the comment back from a lot of the young little girls was, well, why don't you have a girl in the story? So the dolphin actually has a young girl named Christine. And the names are actually my friends from that time. I use their names in different contexts, but a lot of my friends' names are in the book. It was just fun to do.
Yeah, and you talk about seeding a sandbar. How'd that work out?
That actually did work out, but not as quickly as I thought. Oh, it did.
Did it good.
A number of years later, I came back from college and someone had remarked about the amount of clams and things that were discovered in the creek. And no one had ever realized that would be the case. But right in this little loop in the creek where nobody could get to unless you could swim it, which was a good ways, or had a little boat. And it worked out just great. They said they found this whole little sandbar full of clams. But that was 7 or 8 years after the fact.
That's amazing. And you have run it past some children, so.
Oh, yes. That was just a lot of fun doing that. A friend who is a teacher and said, this would be really fun. I was telling her about it. She said, you need to have a reading with the fourth grade class. The other thing to note is that the artist that did the cover and did the artwork actually for the first story is a 13-year-old. Young lady, and she was just phenomenal. And I gave her credit inside the book.
Nice, Dan. Great stories. Thank you. Howard A.W. Carson says he got tired of trying to convince people that climate change is real. So he wrote a story as an allegory. This is the second book in his series. It is entitled Lily Pond, Legacy of the Scrolls.
It's about a couple of young frogs, the main frog, Croaker. He's just kind of sunning himself and enjoying life around the pond. And the twin sisters, Lily and Lotus, Croaker and Weber's girlfriends, happened upon a slither that hadn't been seen in the area for a long time. So they relayed it to Croaker. And so he decides, well, I got to go talk to the sage and have him sound the alarm that there's a danger in the area. And then this sends him on a journey. And shortly after that, his friend Weber also gets sent by the sage on his own journey, and they all try to figure out what's going on, and then finding out that there's a greater danger than any of them knew about. And so they try to make sure that five domains of the realm of Lilypond forge an alliance to confront the threat.
And the threat is their total destruction, right?
Yes.
And where is that coming from?
They find out in the second book, Lilypond, Legacy of the Scrolls, that from reading the scrolls from the ancients that they discovered, they find out that it's an old threat, that imps that are ruled by goblins that live in the wastelands that are coming back to try to destroy them and take all their resources.
What a world you've created. I feel like I'm in Lord of the Rings or something.
It's kind of like that. It's an allegorical fantasy. But I don't have any humans in my story, but, I could have written it with humans, but I don't think it would have had the same appeal.
Humans ruin everything, don't you think?
Yeah, pretty much.
This is Lily Pond, Legacy of the Scrolls.
Yeah, this is the second book, and I'm currently working on the third book called Lily Pond, The Threat Within. It's the story of the ancients. And as I've been writing it, I can see that this is going to be a multiple book series because I can see that there's generations to come between the ancients and back to the first two books.
Are you talking about these books? Do people know about them?
Well, I talk about it here in Minneapolis, and I've had some readings with my first book at the Skyway Senior Center when that was open, and I've done some book signings up in Alexandria, Minnesota. I did a book signing at Book World up there, but since then the store closed down because it couldn't compete with Amazon.
Well, I bet there's more than one senior center.
The senior center was the Skyway Senior Center in downtown Minneapolis. I also volunteered there until they closed. They had a lack of funding, but I was down there for quite a few years as well. And I taught art classes there as well as volunteering there. I enjoyed my art teaching a lot because I've run into people years later that I've taught at the VA. They'll see me on the street or something and they'll say, oh, hey, you're the artist. I was in your class. And I even have one gentleman that's, he was in the mental health ward and was one of the main places where I taught out there. He says, you know, he says, you changed my life. He says, since I got out of there, he's now working at the VA instead of being a patient there.
Oh, Howard, what's better than that? All right, looking forward to your next book. Michelle Morosis has spent a lifetime teaching and tutoring kids, but now she turns her attention to one of her favorite things, writing. And just in time for the holidays, she's published How the Elves Saved Christmas.
Well, you're not going to believe this. I've been writing ever since I was in elementary school. I loved writing. I've been teaching for many, many years. I started out in kindergarten and went all the way to college teaching. And then I was also doing the same in Greece, where I was directing an English language institute. And one night, it was Christmas Eve last year, and I just decided to write this book.
Just came to you in a flash.
In a flash. Actually, it was quick. It was very quick. It just happened. It's the way I write, depending on my inspirations, and take it from there. It's How the Elves Saved Christmas, starting out with Holly and Kirby with their friends, and they get up one morning and decide that Santa's workshop is closed for the holidays. So Holly went on her mission to find out what's going on with Santa, went all the way to his workshop, and then she overheard Santa talking to Mrs. Claus about the fact that they were just not doing very well with a toy situation. They just didn't have enough toys for everyone.
Oh, no. Was it a supply chain issue?
A magical issue. Actually, elves work all year, 12 months, and they decided to take it upon themselves to get the job done as soon as they could. It's really kind of cute. I just decided to get to work, and my illustrations are actually done by an artist. They're paintings. They work very hard. They get everybody on board just in time for Christmas Eve.
So the elves saved Christmas.
Sure did. And so I've got about 100 sold right now.
That's great.
Yeah. So people are really starting to, you know how everyone shops early for Christmas. Actually, I'm having a book signing November 12th at the Barnes & Noble, Muskegon, Michigan. I probably will do one in Detroit also around the holidays. And I do have a student of mine that is planning to read the book at Barnes & Noble on November 12th. One of my students that I tutor, she's 12, and her name is Caitlin, and I believe we are expecting a very big crowd.
All right, Michelle, just in time for Christmas. Finally, let's head out to Brooklyn, Iowa, where we find Ivy Green, a retired concrete worker. And yes, she poured concrete, but that has nothing to do with her story that, like our last author, came to her in a dream, and it's about Christmas. Zora and her stars, the year of the COVID.
Well, Zora, she has a small business, and her mom and dad are in a retirement home. And whenever the COVID came through their town, well, she left her Christmas tree up because she knew that she's going to have to stay home in quarantine. And then her mom and dad caught the COVID. And then her dad told her a secret before he died, which changed Zora and her sister forever. And the book's about coping with the COVID and how it has affected so many lives. And it's so sad. And this is a really strong book about coping and hope and the word of prayer and trying to understand what's going on in this crazy world with the COVID. This was.
All right. So Zora had a small business. What was her business?
She was like an editor to small companies that were publishers.
And she put up a Christmas tree, and after COVID hit, she told the tree, I'm never going to take you down.
Yeah, and she named the tree Star, and she made it beautiful. Then, after the COVID hit and she lost her mom and dad and her best friend, she started losing her mind.
Oh, man, poor Zora.
And it takes her a while to come out of it, but eventually it looks like she is coming out of it and is going to be okay. But you really have to read the story to find out if she did or not.
Okay, so she's trying to let go of her rage. She gets a dog. Does the dog help her at all?
Well, she decides that she's going to go and help the rescue league out and walk some dogs. Something to do. And she goes to this one particular rescue place, and she meets a guy that owns it. His name is Holt. And she walks this dog that is in really bad shape, and she falls in love with it. It's a black lab. So she takes that black lab home with her, and she has never had anything in her life but herself. And she has never had a husband or boyfriend or nothing. Then all of a sudden, now she has a dog that she is trying to share her life with. And she names the dog Star. And then she puts her Christmas tree away. And now she's leaning on this dog to be her comfort. And he loves her back. And then she starts working for this rescue center. And then from there, it off and on. But it has an ending of you don't really know if she died or if she's still alive. I mean, I left it where I could, you know, carry.
So basically, because of COVID, she had to start her life all over again.
Yes.
Well, a lot of people can relate to that. Thank you, Ivy. And before we close out this edition of the Page Publishing Book Club, one of our first authors on this show talked about promoting her book. And I have to tell you, Marlita Smith, author of An Awakening of My Kid Human Power, says she does not miss an opportunity to draw attention to her book right where she lives in her own community.
That's exactly right. And that's what I've been doing. You know, everything has basically been free. It's just that I've been going out there promoting myself and promoting my book in any venue I can. You know, if there's something going on in the community, I just simply show up and I talk to the administrator there and I tell them about my book, and they're like, hey, why don't you come on, you know, and just talk a little bit about your book? How about passing out some of your business cards? And from those, I've gotten lots of leads.
So there you go. If you're going to write, you got to understand the importance of taking your baby out there and showing it to everyone and anyone who will listen. Your book is your baby. You know that, right? So be proud of it and get out there. All right. Right, that's a wrap for this edition of the Page Publishing Book Club. Need a refresh? Go to 710WOR.com and download the podcast. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.